days. Both have a fair amount of rust and dirt on them, but I can't help smiling from ear to ear. They might be old, damaged, and rickety, but these bikes are the most beautiful things I've ever seen. Tomas and I carry the bikes back to the front of the building, and I laugh as I remember the animals I shot. Opossum. The fur is darker and rattier than on the ones we have around Five Lakes Colony, but the cone-shaped face, the rows of tiny sharp teeth, and the furless, scaly tail are unmistakable. And I know from experience, their flesh is edible. Between the bikes and the fresh meat, I am incredibly happy as we set up camp near a group of trees in the center of the buildings. Tomas volunteers to take care of dinner and scout around for a water source while I assess the bicycles and their usability. Using a strip of cot sheet, I clean off the dirt, rust, and grease. One chain has a faulty link, but with a bit of tinkering, I'm able to remove the broken link and get the rest in working order. The three remaining tires of the bikes are deflated, but that's okay. I remove the rubber from the wheels of the first bike and work for the next 3 hours to realign the gears, attach the chain, and get the brake unstuck. The seat cushion has been gnawed by mice or some other rodents, but after stuffing some of the holes with bits of dry grass and sewing a new cover made from the cot sheet, I deem it usable. By the time the sun is starting to descend on the horizon, I am coated with grease and dirt, but one bike is rideable. It might not last very long, but I'm pretty sure even without the rubber tires, the wheels will cover a bunch of miles before giving out. While I've been fixing the first bicycle, the problem of the second one and its lack of a hind wheel has been rolling in the back of my mind. There is no way two of us can ride on one bike, like Daylene and I sometimes did at home. Not for the distance we need to travel. We need two, which means I have to fix the second bike. I think I might have a solution when Tomas calls that dinner is ready. I do my best to wipe the grease from my hands before heading to Tomas and our campsite. When I get there, I'm in for another surprise. While I've been working on the bicycles, Tomas has also been busy. He's not only started a fire, but skinned and roasted both opossum, and boiled the greens and wild carrots with some pine bark. Perhaps the best surprise is the small, fresh, sweet strawberries he found growing wild near the side of one of the buildings. The warm, filling meal feeds the growing sense of hope I've been feeling all day. During dinner, I tell Tomas about the bicycles and my idea to repair the second one using the two cartwheels we found yesterday. We talk about the best way to reconstruct the bicycle and decide to spend the next day here instead of traveling, which we hope will pay off in the end. The next morning, we eat cold opossum and strawberries for breakfast and get to work restructuring the gear assembly on the second bicycle to accommodate the two medium-sized cartwheels I found. It takes most of the day and a lot of scavenging for parts in the town's buildings, but by the time the sun is low in the sky, I am riding the second bicycle around the town square. We eat more strawberries and opossum, drink water Tomas found at a stream about a mile away, and attach scraps of metal behind the seats of our bicycles to create shelves for our bags to rest on while we pedal. When darkness falls, we settle onto the ground and watch the stars appear in the sky. With Tomas's arm around my shoulders, I can only imagine we are sitting in the square back home, watching the heavens with our families somewhere nearby. I turn to say as much to Tomas when his lips find mine in a gentle kiss. My heartbeat quickens. I can't see his face in the darkness, but I know Tomas is giving me the chance to pull away. But I don't. I lean in and feel Tomas's mouth smile against mine before the kiss deepens. I snake a hand around his neck and hold tight as a thrilling shiver travels through me. Despite our tenuous situation, nothing has ever felt this perfect. A distant scream streaks through the night. A human female scream. The sound jolts us apart and into action. I hear Tomas slide his knife out of its leather scabbard as I find my gun. Side by side in the darkness, we wait for the screen to come again. It doesn't. Neither does sleep. Chapter 13. At the first hint of light, we are up, packing our bags, storing them on our new bicycles, and slowly riding off to the southwest. Arms wrapped tight around each other last night, with our weapons a breath away, we whispered assurances that the screamer was far in the distance, that we were safe from whatever caused the outburst. While Tomas's wound appears to be better, I can tell he is having a hard time finding a comfortable spot on his bicycle. Without the rubber tires to absorb some of the friction caused by riding over stones, twigs, and other debris, the ride is a bumpy one. There are also more trees, bushes, and intact houses the farther we get from Chicago. So we decide to head due south, where Tomas's map claims a large roadway used to exist. Even a road in disrepair will be easier to navigate than the terrain we're currently riding on. The other reason for our decision remains unspoken. Last night's scream seemed to come from this direction. We are looking for the girl whose scream kept us alert through the night. If she is injured, we have to help. I couldn't live with myself if we didn't at least try. A flock of crows circling something from above makes my throat tighten. Without a word, we turn and pedal through the patchwork brown grass to whatever has attracted the birds. When we find it, there is no question about helping the screamer or what we would do if she asked to join our team. The body, sprawled on the ground, is past asking for anything. I think I remember the girl marching in front of Malachi and out the lecture hall door to take the first round of tests. Long white blonde hair that is currently matted with dirt and streaks of blood. Eyes that might have once been blue, now bloody sockets as the birds feast. And there in her stomach, a sight that turns my nausea and pity to icy cold fear. A crossbow quarrel. Her testing bag is empty. Either she lost the contents, which I doubt, or the crossbow shooter took them after bringing down his prey, which means he is out there somewhere, hunting.
We should clear out of here.
Tomas gives my hand a squeeze as I stare down at the girl.
The road can't be too far away now.
You're right. We should go. The crossbow shooter might be nearby. And yet, I don't move. I can't leave this girl to be pecked away piece by piece. While she is beyond caring, I am not. She has family, friends, people who love her somewhere, who think she is safely ensconced in Tosu City, showing off her skills in math and science. Those people might never know her fate, but their love for her and hers for them demand respect. This is what my mother and father taught me. It's the Five Lakes colony way of life. Tomas finds a crack in the earth large enough for this slight girl's body. Together we chase away the carrion crows and carry her to what will be her final resting place. I fumble with her identification bracelet until I find the right place to press. The clasp opens and the bracelet with its symbol, a triangle with a small 8-spoked wheel, falls into my hand. We then set her body into the fissure. An hour of daylight is lost as we stack rocks over her to keep the birds and other scavengers from claiming the rest of her remains. I mark the grave with a large reddish rock and wish I knew the girl's name so I could at least bid her a proper goodbye. Instead, I clutch her bracelet to my chest and offer my silent promise that no matter the pressures or fears that come, I will not put aside the beliefs I grew up with in order to pass. Nor will I forget this girl's fate. Tomas's jaw clenches as he gives the grave a final look before we mount our bicycles. Silently, we travel through the rest of the day toward the road we hope to find somewhere over the horizon. We stop only to test and purify water, gather dandelions and wild carrots, and eat more of the opossum and our final apples. My legs are trembling with exhaustion, but the memory of the dead girl and her sightless eyes keeps me pushing the pedals over rocks and underbrush until darkness falls. By late morning on the following day, we find the road. It's a wide paved path that travels far beyond what we can see, which should make me happy. Instead, the condition of the road fills me with dread. There are no holes, no breaks in the asphalt. Other than recent patches here and there, I see no signs of disrepair. This time Tomas doesn't question me as I dismount my bicycle. "Do you think this is another trap?" I ask.
"After the pond, anything's possible."
He cocks his head to one side.
"But I don't think so. Look down there."
I squint in the direction he's pointing toward and see it. Far in the distance is a line of bright blue cutting across the countryside. The southern testing fence line. The one we're not supposed to cross beyond.
"I bet they fixed this road in order to install the fence."
Tomas digs into his bag and pulls out his book.
"According to the map, this road goes all the way to the southwestern side of the old state and connects with another road that leads right to Tosu City. The officials have to have an easy way of getting back and forth from Tosu City to the start of the test. I'm betting this is it."
The reasoning is sound, but it isn't Tomas's logic that sways me. It's the map itself, which tells me this road leads through several major cities on the way to Tosu City. My father's most vivid nightmare took place in a city where the buildings still stood. If the testing officials are going to lay traps for us, those cities are the most logical places to set them. "Let's throw a few rocks under the road," I say. "If it doesn't explode, we should try it." Tomas laughs and looks around for some ammunition. His arm is better than mine, but between the two of us, we land about a dozen rocks onto the pavement without incident, and we decide to trust it. After riding over twigs, rocks, and tree roots, pedaling over the smooth surface is like heaven. After the horror of burying the unnamed girl, I'm glad for the wind and sun on my face. The freedom of riding fast. No matter the daunting number of miles that we still have to cross, I'm glad to be alive. After the initial joy of riding on the pavement passes, I realize taking the road has not only improved our speed, it has also increased our visibility to whoever might be watching from the thickets of trees and abandoned buildings along the way. I hope the crossbow shooter and any others intent on removing the competition have not yet found speedy transportation. We ride over a long bridge that spans a wide, opaque river, and I suggest we camp near the water for the night. It's earlier than we normally make camp, but I'm dirty. My hair is matted with grime and sweat, and my legs are starting to cramp. The abundance of water means an opportunity to feel clean for the first time in days. It's also a good place to forage for food and maybe even trap game. Tomas is more than willing to stop, especially when he checks Zine's device and sees we've traveled just over 45 miles in a single day. We are now a seventh of the way to Tosu City. While it's still far, the bicycles and the road we travel give us both a more optimistic view of this test. The river, like all untreated water sources, is tainted. But one look into the swirling waters tells us that at least some species of fish have adapted to the contaminants. While the contaminants make it dangerous to eat the fish raw, a pan and a fire will make them more than edible. I roam the banks of the river, gathering plants for dinner, while Tomas attaches a hook from his toolkit to a braided strip of sheet. He goes fishing using the last bits of our opossum as bait. By the time I return with a pot filled with wild onions, pickerel weed, and cattail roots, Tomas has caught and cleaned 3 medium-sized fish. 2 catfish and one that looks similar to the wide-mouth bass we catch near home. We boil the cattail roots and pickerel weed, fry the wild onion and fish, and have a feast. With the sun still an hour or two from setting, I decide to wash. Our tests have determined the water contaminant is mild and won't affect skin on contact, so I strip down to my undergarments and wade into the cool water. The current is surprisingly strong. I don't venture far from the bank as I scrub the mud, dust, and sweat from my body and the clothes I've been wearing for the past few days. When I climb out, I give myself a few minutes to air dry before pulling on my second set of clothing and hanging the wet ones over a branch to dry. I'm about to call to Tomas that I'm finished with my bath when I see him still and quiet, positioned behind a clump of bushes on the hill that leads to the road. His muscles are taut. His hand clutches the hilt of his knife. He's spotted something. Gripping my handgun, I'm careful to step softly, avoiding the rocks and branches, keeping to the grassy patches that will deaden my tread. Tomas jumps as I touch his shoulder, but then he points far down the road in the direction we have already traveled. People. 3 of them. At this distance, it's hard to tell whether they're male or female, but their feet drag on the ground, telling us they're tired, hungry, and possibly dehydrated. Even with the slow pace, the 3 will be here before the sun sets.
Do you want to pack up and move farther away from the road, or should we stay put and see if they notice us?
Tomas asks.
What do you think?
Tomas frowns.
They look pretty tired to me. If I didn't know about our crossbow friend, I'd say flag them down and see if we can help. They won't expect us to travel with them since they're on foot and we're on bicycles. Still,
I can finish his thoughts. There are candidates out there willing to shoot, to kill, to get a passing grade on this test no matter the cost.
But we're not like them.
As if to prove it, I say,
why don't you catch a few more fish in case they make it this far before nightfall? They're going to be hungry.
Tomas's eyes narrow as he studies the trio. After a moment, he agrees. There are 5 fish roasting over coals when the 3 candidates step off the bridge onto our side of the river. All 3 look vaguely familiar. 1 gangly, freckled, red-haired boy, 2 girls. One is tall with olive skin and short dark hair. The other has long ash blonde hair and is several inches shorter. All three look as though they're ready to drop from exhaustion. Are you hungry? I ask, stepping out from my hiding place. Tomas is still behind the bushes, with the knife poised in his hand. We agreed that the trio might be more inclined toward aggression if they saw both of us. I hope a single smallish girl will inspire them to think before they react. The three don't look surprised at my appearance. I suppose the smell of food cooking alerted them to the presence of another human being. But their eyes gleam with terror as they notice the gun in my hand. I feel bad, but I don't lower it. I'm not that naive. You look like you're hungry and tired. I have fish cooking and some water down by the river if you'd like to make camp here tonight. The tall red-headed boy speaks first. Why would you want to help us? I give them the only answer I have. It's what I was raised to do. Whether they believe the honesty of my words, or they're just so hungry they can't resist the smell of the cooking fish, the trio follows me off the road. I warn them I'm not traveling alone, and while the shorter of the girls looks terrified at the sight of Tomas and his knife, the others don't appear concerned. Especially not when they spot the food and water waiting for them. They keep their bags close at hand as they sit on the ground. The tall girl starts to cry when I say, "Help yourself to the food." In between mouthfuls of fish, the tall girl tells us her name is Tracelyn. The other two are Stacia and Vic. All three are from Tulsa Colony. They were sitting together in the lecture hall when Dr. Barnes showed the map of the fourth test, and, like us, they set up a meeting point. For them, it was the fence line directly south of the starting location. It took them 2 days to find one another, and they've been traveling near the road ever since, only leaving it to look for food and water. Food has been scarce, and they haven't wanted to venture far from the road to find more familiar plant life. The road has been their greatest source of safety, since they can see people coming and hide if necessary. "We were hiding in an abandoned building when you rode past," Vic admits, taking another helping of fish. "I thought you were miles and miles ahead, so it never occurred to me to look for bicycle tracks on the side of the road. I should have been more careful, but the smell of food distracted me. You guys seem to be playing things straight, but not everyone is." "We know." Tomas meets Vic's eyes. The two seem to size each other up. Vic looks at the knife in the scabbard on Tomas's belt, at the gun resting in my lap, and nods. "Someone took a couple pot shots at me while I was getting out of the city," he says. "With a gun or a crossbow?" I ask. Tracelyn's eyes widen. "Someone's shooting at people with a crossbow? I just don't understand how anyone can do that kind of thing. I mean, the testing committee said they're going to evaluate us on the choices we make. They can't possibly give someone a passing grade for shooting the competition. What kind of leader would that person be?" "A strong one." This from Stacia, who until now has sat cross-legged on the ground, eyes firmly fixed on her food. The fourth stage of war would never have happened if the President of the United States had attacked the Asian alliance. Instead, he tried to broker a worldwide coalition, even when his own advisors said it was useless. He was a pacifist when the country needed aggression. Tomas shakes his head. "Striking first would have guaranteed a strike by the Asian alliance. He knew the damage the first three stages of war had caused. He had to try and head off what he was certain would be the destruction of the world." "Fat lot of good it did." Stacia laughs. "Isn't that the point the testing committee was making when they dropped us in one of the destroyed cities? They're looking for candidates with a killer instinct. I don't believe that, I say. My father passed the testing, and he's a pacifist. He believes in creating, not destroying. Stacia shrugs. Well, maybe he lied in his evaluation and told the committee he took a few of the candidates out while making his way back to civilization. I mean, how are they going to know he lied? It's not like they can see what we're doing out here. Or can they? I remember the camera in the skimmer, the ones in the log cabin we lunched in, the cameras in our sleeping quarters back at the testing center. The most direct route to Tosu City from Chicago stretches 700 miles. Tomas figures there is a 20 or 30-mile stretch of land in between the fence lines. There's no way the testers have planted enough cameras in the landscape to cover every inch of ground. But what if they don't need to? What if there's another way to keep track of our actions? The conversation shifts from the testing to talk of home. Tomas, Vic, and Tracelin share information about our two colonies. Tulsa Colony has more than 70,000 people living in the southern half of what used to be Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the countryside that stretches beyond the city limits. There's an oil refinery still active in Tulsa that Vic's father works at. Tracelin's parents both work at the power plant, the largest operational plant in any of the colonies. Stacia doesn't seem interested in sharing information about her family. She just lies back on the ground and stares at the sky as the stars begin to shine through the haze. I wonder what she's thinking as the boys compare weapons. Both girls have knives. Vic has a handgun like mine. I'm glad they've been honest about their protection, but I have to wonder if I'll sleep, knowing candidates I don't fully trust are armed. We leave the fire burning as we assign pairs to keep watch as the others sleep. Vic and Tomas, me and Tracelin. Stacia doesn't even question not being assigned watch duty as she curls up in a ball and falls asleep. I give my gun to Tomas since he has first watch and close my eyes while wondering if these people are worthy of the little trust we've given them. If not, I doubt I'll live to see the morning. But I do. Tracelin and I are awakened after several blissful hours of sleep and together watch the sun rise on a new day. In the peacefulness, I learn that if she makes it to the university, Tracelin wants to be a teacher. She's also in love with a boy back home and was planning on marrying him. He wasn't chosen for the testing, which means they'll most likely never see each other again. "You're lucky both you and your boyfriend were chosen," she says with quiet sincerity. "Tomas isn't my boyfriend." I feel the blush on my cheeks. "You could have fooled me." She gives me a wide smile. "I think he's in love with you." "He's just watching out for me, you know, since we're from the same colony," I say. But I can't help the thrill I feel at her words. Deep down, I hope she's right, because with every day that passes, I'm more certain that I'm falling in love with him. She changes the subject and we talk about our families, the tests we've taken thus far, and the distance we still have to travel in order to pass this test. She seems so genuinely sweet and a touch too trusting, which coming from me is saying something. I share our experience with the clean pond of water and the perfectly green glade of grass that ultimately exploded. Whether or not she believes me, I know I've tried to help make her aware of the dangers out here. As the sun rises, so do our companions. Stacia sits far away from us as we eat breakfast. Tomas and I barely rate a glance as we say goodbye and head out before the others can follow. We find the thicket where we hid our bikes, carry them to the road, and begin to pedal. As the miles pass, I can't help but think of the candidates we left behind and wonder if they'll cross the finish line. There is a quiet determination about Stacia that makes me think she'll make it, but something about her fierce smile and the logic she ascribes to the testing committee gives me concern for her companions. As our bicycles eat up the miles, I think again about how the testing committee will evaluate us when we arrive back in Tosu City. From everything I've seen thus far, I can't believe Dr. Barnes and the other officials would be content with candidate reports on what occurred during the test. Which means somehow we're being monitored. If not all the time, then off and on, enough for them to make their decisions. By the time we pull off the road and find an abandoned farm to make camp at, I'm certain I know how the testers are keeping track of us. But I'll have to wait to check my theory until we've settled in for the night. If I'm right, the testers will know if I deviate from the routine Tomas and I have set since starting our journey. There are clouds gathering to the west that indicate a storm is coming, and neither Tomas nor I have any interest in sleeping in a downpour. A faded gray wooden barn that tilts to the left catches our eye. Despite the leaning walls, the structure appears to be sound. We step into the barn and startle a group of wild chickens. Four gunshots later, we have three of them ready to be plucked and roasted. Their nests yield four light brown eggs, which we save for breakfast tomorrow. I try hard to act normal as we make and eat dinner, although Tomas shoots me more than one questioning look as we work. Finally, dinner is over. As I store leftovers in my bag, I use the opportunity to dig for something else. The minute my fingers close over it, my heart skips in anticipation, and I pull it out into the light. The identification bracelet I took from the girl we buried. Every testing candidate has one, two actually, since a smaller band with our symbol is attached to our bags. We've all been instructed to wear them at all times. Since the clasps are hard to detect, I'm certain most testing candidates have heeded this rule. The bracelets are our identification. Could they also be an invisible leash designed to tell the testers where we are and what we're doing? The bracelet is a quarter of an inch thick and made of a silver metal. The disc affixed to the top contains an etching of the testing candidate's design, and the back... there. In the middle of the area, directly behind the etched testing symbol, are three small holes. Pinpricks, really. So small, I'd never have noticed them if I hadn't been looking for something specific. But they tell me what I need to know. Someone is listening. Chapter 14. A surge of satisfaction streaks through me, the kind I always feel when I ace a test. This time the pleasure is gone as quickly as it came, replaced by the slick, acrid taste of dread. Have the testers been recording every word we've spoken? Did they listen in on my conversations before I reached Tosu City? Or would they have not thought to bother since almost every move I made was recorded by their tiny cameras? I can't help but pray for the latter to be true. Otherwise, they know. They know about my father, his nightmares, the warnings he gave me. He told me to trust no one, but I didn't listen. I decided I knew best. I trusted Tomas. I told him everything. And in doing so, I might have jeopardized my father's life. Because any government that is willing to stand by and watch as candidates commit suicide or ingest poisonous plants because they gave a wrong answer won't shrink from eliminating a man they might see as a threat. And Magistrate Owens, Dr. Flint, our old teacher, everyone who worked hard to keep Five Lakes Colony graduates safe from the testing is at risk because of me.
See, are you okay?
I whip around and see Tomas staring at me. I must look pretty awful to warrant the concern in his eyes. Forcing a wide smile, I say, "Yeah, I'm just worried about Tracelin and the others. I hope they find shelter tonight. It looks like a big storm is coming." Then I put my finger to my lips, point to the bracelet in my hand, and show him the almost imperceptible holes on the inside. With unsteady fingers, I probe for the clasp on my bracelet, work the fastening free, and set it on top of my bag. I then take Tomas's hand and remove his before heading out the door into the swirling wind.
"They've been spying on us," Tomas says. "I guess it shouldn't come as a surprise after the exploding pond. Listening to private conversations is minor compared to that."
"But how long do you think they've been listening? Just this test, or since the beginning?" I watch him consider the question and see the moment he remembers our conversation under the tree, away from the cameras.
"Maybe they weren't listening then. I mean, at that point, there were 108 of us. Most likely they were just using the cameras so they could observe us all at once. Listening to over 100 different microphones would take a lot of time and people."
I can only hope he's right. I don't know if I can live with the alternative.
"Sia, I know this is hard, but you can't worry about what might be happening to everyone back home."
His hand brushes over my cheek. I catch it and hold it like a lifeline.
"The only way for us to help anyone at home is to survive this test."
My throat tightens as desperation takes hold. "If we pass, they'll remove all our testing memories. We won't remember there's anything we need to help with."
"Not if we figure out how they do it."
He gives my hand a squeeze and brushes the stray tears that have slipped down my cheek.
"I've been thinking about it, and I have a few ideas. Now that we know about the bugs, we can make sure they won't always know what we're planning. You've given us an advantage. We just have to be smart enough to use it."
The doubts I have threaten to consume me. Are we smart enough? Can we outthink a system that has been in place for decades, that's controlled the lives of hundreds of the brightest minds since the world began to rebuild, that is currently controlling us? Straightening my shoulders, I say, "Well, then we'll just have to be smart enough, right?"
"Right."
Tomas smiles.
"With the two of us working together, how can we go wrong? And you know what? I'm glad you figured out someone was listening in for another reason."
"Why is that?"
"Because the first time I tell you that I'm in love with you, I'd rather not share the moment with Dr. Barnes and his friends."
The words and the way his lips touch mine make my heart shimmer. I know this is the wrong time to be thinking about love. The stress of the test, knowing our lives are in danger, means I can't trust my emotions. But the warmth in my veins and the strength I feel just being near Tomas are real. So when his lips leave mine, I'm able to say, "I think I love you too."
"You think?"
He laughs and hugs me tight against his chest.
"Well, I guess it's good I have a couple hundred miles of road left to convince you."
He drops a kiss on the top of my head and sighs. We should probably go back and entertain our listening audience before they start wondering if we've passed out from eating too much chicken. He takes my hand and we start back toward the barn. You do realize I'm going to have to declare my love again for our audience. Otherwise, they might start wondering why I'm telling you how beautiful you are. I can't help smiling as we walk back into the building and snap the bracelets back onto our wrists. But now that I know people are listening, I can't seem to come up with anything to say. Thankfully, Tomas doesn't have the same problem. I thought I heard a noise outside, but I guess I was wrong. No one was there. Guess with the storm coming, the wind kicked up some debris. For a second, I'm confused. Then I realize he's explaining the silence to whoever was listening. Good, I say. We could both use the rest after last night. I'm not sorry we invited the others to camp with us, but it was hard to sleep with them there.
I know.
Tomas lowers himself to the ground and pats the spot next to him, which I take.
I didn't get much sleep either.
Then how do you explain your snoring? I tease, even though Tomas doesn't snore. Our audience will no doubt find it amusing. We talk about the other three candidates for a while and then speculate on how our friends might be doing, whether they've teamed up with others or are traveling alone. The wind howls in earnest and raindrops begin to pound against the roof. Once the barn is completely draped in shadows, we get ready for sleep. Settling into the back corner spot we thought was best protected from the weather, we listen as rain pours from the sky. Water drips from holes in the roof, but the area we've chosen stays blissfully dry. Tomas puts his arm around me and says,
You know, I really did lie awake for most of last night. I don't know if this is the right time to say this, but Tracelin is right. I am in love with you.
Hearing it for the second time, even if he's saying it for Dr. Barnes, still makes my breath catch. Like last time, Tomas kisses me, but this kiss is longer, deeper, and stirs my blood. When he pulls away, it takes me longer to recover. Smiling in the dark, I snuggle up against him and whisper,
I think I love you too.
His answering chuckle chases me into sleep. Something's wrong. Tomas's arm is still wrapped around me. His breathing is even and steady. A pale gray light streams through the barn. The rain has stopped. I put my head back down and close my eyes, trying to catch a few more minutes of sleep. And that's when I hear it. Panting. Something is here. My eyes fly open and I raise my head and look around the dim interior of the barn. Nothing. At least, not that I can see. The panting sound is nearby. I close my eyes to pinpoint the sound. It's coming from behind me. Heart pounding, I slide out from under Tomas's arm, slowly sit up, and turn my head to look at the wall behind us. There's nothing there, but I can still hear the rapid inhale and exhale of air. There's a long crack in the corner of the wall where sunlight is streaming in. Being careful not to disturb Tomas, I quietly get to my feet, peer through it, and bite back a scream. The animal is massive. Standing on its haunches, it's as tall as I am, with black and gray fur covering most of its body. In places here and there, leathery pink skin peeks through. What captures my attention most, though, are the hooked claws and the teeth, several rows of them, yellow and sharp in a wide, protruding mouth. Is it a kind of bear or a wolf? If it's either, this version is unlike any of the species I've ever seen. My father has shown me pictures that he took on the outskirts of one of the colonies he worked in, pictures of animals twisted by the same chemicals and radiation that laid waste to the earth. Some of the animals developed extra limbs or lost their tails. Others lost their fur or gained skin almost impenetrable to weapons. Regardless of the change, every mutated animal became vicious. The smallest rodents with their hairless bodies and oversized ears would attack a human no matter their size. This animal, whatever it might be, outside the barn, isn't small. It's huge. If it attacks, we will be in serious trouble. And it's not alone. The large black head swings to the right, and I can see another grayer but equally scary animal standing behind it. It sniffs the air. Has it caught our scent? I think so. Which means we need to get out of here now. I'm grateful we kept our things packed because we have to move fast. Kneeling, careful not to make a sound, I gently shake Tomas awake. His gray eyes open. His mouth smiles as he sees me, but the warmth and happiness leave his face as he notices the fear on mine. His eyes narrow as I lean close to his ear and whisper, "There are mutated animals outside. We have to get moving." He nods and is on his feet, bag in hand, in seconds. Together we cross to the other side of the barn. Every scuff of our shoes or rustle of dry grass under our feet makes my heart jump. Once we're at the door, Tomas whispers, "We'll run with our bicycles until we get to the road, then we'll ride, okay?" The barn is about 150 yards from the road. There are rocks, trees, and underbrush between us and the pavement, not to mention the way back to the road slants uphill. I have no idea how the hook-clawed wolves move or how fast they can run. Perhaps they won't notice us. Or even if they do, maybe we will be far enough away for them not to give chase. If they do, well, I hope they lumber like bears. That might give us a chance. If they're swifter. I clutch my gun, take a deep breath, and say, "Okay, let's do it." My feet pound the hard-packed earth. My hands hold tight to the handlebars as I keep my eyes focused on the road. The bicycle wheels bang and jump as they roll over the harsh terrain, but I don't look back to see if we've been noticed. That will only slow me down. If the animals and their vicious-looking teeth are in pursuit, I can't afford the delay. But Tomas does look back. I can tell by the way he sucks in air, the way he wills himself to go even faster as he yells, "Run, Sia, run!" I do. I run as fast as I'm able. My calf and thigh muscles burn as I propel myself and the bicycle up the hill that leads to the road. To our hope for escape that lies at least another 50 yards in the distance. With his longer legs and superior strength, Tomas pulls ahead of me. He yells for me to keep running, and I am, but I can only go so fast. And then I hear it. Panting. Branches cracking. Yips and whines. They're close. Too close. And getting closer. Fear, swift and fierce, helps move my legs faster. I climb the incline. Twice I almost lose hold on my bicycle as my feet catch in the underbrush, but I manage to keep climbing. Somewhere behind me the yips become growls. The sounds are closer. They're catching up, and I still have at least 10 yards until I reach the road. A bicycle pedal catches on a bush, and I tumble to the ground. I look up and see Tomas at the top of the hill. He's already seated on his bicycle, poised to take flight.
Come on, Sia, hurry.
He doesn't say it, but I know the animals are moments behind me. There's nothing he can do to help me unless I make it to the top. So I scramble to my feet, pick the bicycle off the ground to keep it from catching on branches and grass, and force myself up the last incline. My feet hit smooth pavement, and I want to cry with relief, but I can't. Out of the corner of my eye, I see them. A pack of them. Six or more. They're fast. Large, bulky shapes of gray and black matted fur. 10 or 15 feet behind me. Jaws open, ready to attack. One leaps out in front of the others. Its wide yellow eyes are focused on me as it closes the gap between us. I aim and fire. The thing growls in anger as the bullet hits it square in the chest, but it doesn't stop. The bullet doesn't even slow it down.
We can't take them out. Get on. We gotta go.
Tomas's voice snaps me into action. I throw my leg over the bicycle frame. My feet hit the pedals and push. The sound of claws on pavement and the snarls of our pursuers get my legs pumping faster. The rickety metal beneath me protests as it picks up speed. I pray my handiwork won't give out on me now. Tomas is right. These creatures, whatever they are too strong for us to kill with a handgun or a knife. If we can't outrace them... Tomas yells encouragement back to me as the road slants downward. My wheels pick up speed. There are howls behind me, but they sound like they're dropping back. I keep pedaling, willing the animals to give up the chase, to find a different, less speedy prey for their morning meal. And they do. The yips and growls grow fainter. When I no longer hear the sounds of the animals in pursuit, I brave a look behind and see in the distance that the pack is leaving the road, heading north, away from us. Still, we keep riding in case the creatures think to circle around and come at us from the other side. That kind of thinking takes higher reasoning and calculated determination, more than most animals are capable of, but there are stories told around campfires to scare children, stories as well about humans who survived the radiation and the chemicals but were horribly changed. Never did I believe those stories were true, but I would never have believed the United Commonwealth capable of killing testing candidates to aid in their selection process. So while the animals we are escaping showed no signs of human characteristics, we ride another 15 miles before we stop and catch our breath. I lay my bicycle on the ground and walk into Tomas's waiting arms. Pressing my head against his chest, I hear his heart hammering hard and know mine is pounding equally fast. We're alive. Since being shot at hours after the test began, I've been focused on the dangers my competition might bring or the ones the testing officials have put in place. I'd almost forgotten to worry about the animals roaming the damaged plains. Although now that I think about it, I have to wonder if they're out here by accident or design. The testers erected fences. If they're high enough to keep us in, wouldn't it stand to reason they would keep animals not welcomed by the testers out? Pulling away from the comfort of Tomas's arms, I dig out a water bottle and swallow the bitter taste of fear and fatigue. I hand Tomas the bottle and unwrap the food we intended to prepare for our morning's breakfast. Miraculously, the eggs, wrapped carefully in my clothing, have survived unbroken. Tomas suggests we make a fire and cook them, since we need to rest for a while anyway. Our race to safety has left us both exhausted. At least, that's what I think when we first gather twigs and sticks for the fire. As Tomas kneels down to light a match, I notice the blood seeping through the back of his pants. The sight stops me cold, and I realize how bloodless his face has gotten now that the color of exertion has disappeared. The match trembles in his hand as he lights the twigs and coaxes them into a crackling fire. I pull my medical kit out and order Tomas to lie on the ground. He flashes me a pained grin.
Tell a girl you love her and she automatically gets bossy. Well, I guess I can't complain since you're asking me to take off my pants.
I laugh, but a tear in the cauterized wound puts an end to my amusement. And once I wash away the blood, I can see a slight redness that speaks of infection. The infection isn't bad, yet, but it could be if we aren't careful. Seeing the possible contagion makes me decide to change treatment options. Not that this one will be any easier. I make Tomas take several pain tablets and drink a lot of water before I sterilize a needle, thread it, and begin work. Tomas flinches as the needle slides into his flesh. Or maybe it was me who flinched. My heart thuds, my stomach clenches, and I grit my teeth as I push the needle back through tissue, pull the thread taut, and do it again. The tear is less than a half inch long, but each stitch is so small that it takes a dozen of them to complete the job. Tomas doesn't make a sound, but every wince on his face makes my heart ache. Dr. Flint told me once that it's hard for doctors to work on people they love, and that he hoped he'd never have to perform surgery on Dad or any of us kids, for fear that love would get in the way of his training. Working the needle in and out of Tomas's flesh, I understand Dr. Flint's words. My fingers are slick with red when I make the last stitch and tie and cut the knot. I'm shaking and queasy as I slather the anti-infection ointment on the wound and place another bandage over it. Tomas is in worse shape. Traveling now isn't an option. I wash the blood from my hands and tell Tomas to sleep while I get food ready. His eyes are closed before I can dig out the pan. I decide to postpone cooking for a while. After all that blood, the idea of handling or eating food doesn't appeal. Gun in hand, I do a search in the area for something to cook with the eggs and score some wild onion. I also find a patch of ripe, wild raspberries. I let Tomas sleep for more than 2 hours, as long as I dare. When his eyes open, I'm thrilled to see they are bright and clear and filled with annoyance at being left to sleep the day away. Although, when we finish eating, it's obvious that no matter how much he might want to travel, riding isn't a good idea. Tomas is weakened from the blood loss, and the injury is too tender. So we walk, wheeling our bicycles beside us for hours and taking short breaks for Tomas to rest. We find a river, but the water is poisonous and can't be purified, at least not with the chemicals in my bag. Our progress isn't fast, but it's constant, and by the end of the day, we can see buildings in the distance. An abandoned city, and the road we're traveling runs right through it. Chapter 15. The sight of the buildings makes me shiver. The streets in between the buildings could house anything, wild animals, other candidates, or worse. From here, the city looks to go on for miles. Even without the threat of danger lurking around every corner, I don't relish entering its depths. Tomas and I have been foraging for plants and treating water from the ponds and brooks we've encountered along the way. I doubt we'll be able to do the same in a world comprising decaying stone and steel. With the threat of the city looming in the distance, I set out dinner and say, The city would be the perfect location for the officials to add some additional tests. Most candidates will probably pass through the city instead of going around because it looks like the faster route. I think of my father and his nightmare. Whatever happened to his friends took place in a city like the one sprawled out before us. Tomas meets my eyes and nods. He understands what I'm thinking and what I'm careful not to say with the testers listening in.
Or they could place traps on the roads leading around the city to make sure candidates have to travel through it. They're going to want to see how we react when we come across other people. Look.
He points to the south, and I squint into the setting sun.
The southern fence line bumps right up against the city. I can't see the northern boundary, but I'm betting it's closer than we think.
Weapons tight in our hands, we let sleep claim us and are up and ready to travel with the dawn. A survey of our supplies has us looking for water as the city looms closer. We find a small murky pond coated with a black oily substance about 100 yards from the road. 3 of the purification chemicals are needed to treat the water, and even still I am concerned about its safety. Storing the water, I hope we find another source before we're forced to drink it. If not, well, we'll have to take our chances. While I don't relish being poisoned, I like the idea of dehydration even less. Tomas insists he's okay to ride and grits his teeth as he takes his seat. His obvious pain makes me reevaluate my plan to go around the city. If Tomas's injury doesn't improve, we'll need a better mode of transportation. A city with all of its abandoned stores and buildings could be the best place to find a vehicle. The road we're traveling forks. The section that swings to the right and travels on the outskirts of the city is in serious disrepair. I doubt our bicycles would last more than a few minutes navigating the broken pavement. The fork that leads into the center of the city is perfectly smooth. The obvious sign of direction from our testers makes my muscles clench. But there really isn't much of a choice. We'll follow the road and get to the other side as fast as we can. The road narrows, and we begin to pass the occasional building. Most of them are only 2 or 3 stories tall. None are in good repair. In fact, considering the number of holes in the roofs and walls, I'm amazed the structures are standing at all. We make a point to stay in the middle of the road in case the testers have rigged the dilapidated buildings to collapse as we pass. As the buildings grow taller and are spaced closer together, we see ones that have collapsed. In each instance, the building wreckage blocks a road leading off from the one on which we're traveling. At first, I think I'm imagining it, but when we pass the 5th different building collapsed over a fork in the road, I know I'm right. The testing officials are herding us in a straight line, toward whatever they have planned. I yell to Tomas and stop in the middle of the road. He puts his feet down and turns to me. What's wrong? I explain about the collapsed buildings and my worry about what might lie ahead.
Do you want to go back and travel around the city?
By his annoyed expression, I know Tomas does not. And to be honest, I'm not sure if I do. Going around might be equally dangerous, and we've already spent the morning coming this far. If we go back to where we started, we'll have wasted the entire day.
No, not really. I just want us to be careful.
He gives me a quick kiss and grins.
I promise not to throw rocks at any ponds unless I clear it with you, okay?
His smile makes my heart turn over, and despite my lingering worries, I find myself smiling back. I'm going to hold you to that. We set off at a slower pace, watching the buildings and pavement in front of us for signs of danger. Anything could be hidden 10 or 12 stories up. Cameras, traps, anything. After pedaling almost 4 more miles, we come to an intersection of roads. This time, there are no piles of stone and metal to block our way. Instead, there are 3 unblocked paths. One that stretches in front of us and 2 that jut off to either side.
What do you think?
Tomas places his feet on the pavement.
I think now is a good time to start chucking rocks.
Tomas laughs but then climbs off his bicycle, grabs a large rock, and lobs it down the center path. It hits the ground and skips another 10 feet across the pavement. He does the same for the other 2. The rocks hit the ground and skid to a halt without incident.
Now what?
I don't know. We look down each path, trying to envision what it might hold. The path ahead and the one to the left are surrounded by buildings all similar in structure to the ones we've passed on our way to this point. Far to our right is a building that catches our attention. The gray structure is long. The center of the building stands several stories taller than the rest and is capped by a large dome. If for no better reason than we're curious to get a better look, we set off to the right and come to a dead end. The domed building that once must have been magnificent is now crumbling. It and 2 collapsed buildings on either side block our way. Is part of the test figuring out how to get beyond these barriers or something else? While I consider the implications, Tomas picks up a rock and lobs it onto a set of broken stairs. Nothing happens. The 2 of us smile at each other, but before Tomas starts forward, I say, "Try another rock, just to be sure." Tomas picks up another rock and hurls it toward the rubble to our left. For a moment there is silence, before a faint ticking sound fills the air. A moment later, the patch of ground where the rock landed explodes. There's no going around or over. Leaving the road is the wrong answer. A decision that will be punished. Wordlessly, we follow the road back to the fork and choose the path that leads straight ahead. Another dead end. We don't bother to test this one for traps. We know they're there. The left path takes us past several buildings that once might have been shops. A faded but partially legible sign boasts hardware. Part of me itches to stop and explore whatever inventory might still be usable, but I don't. The road that once terrified me is now a source of safety. The road zigzags around the crumbling gray buildings and eventually comes to another fork. Once again, we have 3 choices. We take the middle one, pass more decaying structures, and come to a dead end that shows signs of a recent explosion. We turn around, and I realize what this reminds me of. A maze. We're in a maze. When I was growing up, my father used to draw me and my brothers complicated mazes and then ask us to solve them. Kind of like a race. All of us would be given the same maze, and Dad would wait until we were all ready before telling us to start. Once we touched the tip of our pencil to the paper, we were not allowed to pick it back up. If we ran into a dead end, we were out of the race. Dad was teaching us to think and plan ahead, not to rush into any decision too quickly without considering what the outcome would be. Perhaps somewhere in his fragmented memory, he remembered this part of the test. Or maybe he was just giving us a game to pass the cold, snowy nights. Whatever the reason, I need to use the lesson it taught and think ahead. Already it's late in the day. If we aren't careful, we could be trapped in this maze longer than our supply of food and water will hold out. I tell Tomas we should break for an early dinner. He's frustrated and hot enough to agree, so we sit down in the middle of the road and pull out the chicken, since it will be the first to spoil in this heat. While we eat, I ask to see Tomas's book of maps. Together we pore over the pages. According to the book, the road we want to take out of the city is on the southwest side. That means we should choose paths in directions that should ultimately lead us to that road. The more straight and south-traveling paths we can take, the better. Well, it isn't much information, but it's more than we had when we sat down. We hop back on our bicycles and start pedaling. Another fork. We take the left road. More undistinguishable buildings. A dead end. Back to the fork and straight ahead. Our shirts are soaked with sweat as we continue to search for the right roads. Even with the compass as a guide, the twists and turns are confusing my sense of direction. At nightfall, we have no choice but to make camp. Without light, we risk stepping off the road and tripping a trap. We opt to camp in the center of the road, near a dead end. The three booby-trapped sides will at least limit the direction from which new dangers can arrive. We eat the remainder of the chicken and save the greens and the last bag of dried fruit for morning. We'll have to think our way out of this maze before hunger takes hold. In the heat of the day, we tried to ration our water intake, but now our lips are cracking from a combination of heat and dehydration. We have no choice but to open the bottles that might contain contaminants. The taste is a little off, but neither Tomas nor I detect the metallic or bitter flavors that mean certain death. The one bright spot is that Tomas's wound seems better as I change the bandage and apply more ointment.
"That's because I'm being treated by the best," he says, and gives me a kiss.
The hope of the healing wound and the warmth of his lips help me fall into a fast sleep. Frustration returns with the light. Often we think we're on the right path, only to find several turns later that we have to backtrack. More worrisome are the voices we begin to hear somewhere in the distance. Some voices sound as though they're just on the other side of a barrier or building. It's impossible to tell. But one thing is certain. We're not alone in this maze. There are other rats scampering after the seemingly elusive exit. An explosion rattles the buildings next to us. A scream scrapes the air. Then another. Then silence. We pedal faster, away from the explosion. Down one road. Dead end. Backtrack. Choose another path. We try to make jokes when we come to the inevitable barriers that make us turn back. But hour after hour of searching, and the jokes come less easily. Our laughter is more forced, until there's nothing left to laugh at. My scalp itches from the dirt and sweat. My body aches from the constant exertion that seems to be getting us nowhere. We eat the last of the dried fruit. Tomas finds a stale roll in his bag, and we split it to curb the hunger gnawing inside us. The only good news is that we're not yet feeling the effects of the marginally tainted water. And even that news feels grim when we realize that the water will not hold out for much longer. Not a single cloud dots the sky to offer the hope of rain. My tired leg muscles protest when we choose a path that slants uphill. I force my feet to move the pedals. The higher up the incline we go, the better our view of the city. We aren't that high, but here and there, where buildings have collapsed from age, we can see beyond our patch of road. And when I squint into the distance, I think I can see the long domed building that we encountered when we first entered the maze. It's far, far away. I point it out to Tomas, who gives me the first genuine smile of the day. Well, the end can't be that far away, right? Let's go find it. The Lord